Hello? Okay. I'm Eric. This work was done at NEC Laboratories with Cesari and Christian. Cesari is still working on the back-end store, but in Poland at a startup called Nine Lives Data. I'm going to talk about something which, in contrast to some of the ideas we've heard in the past few days, is very, very simple. Good for Friday morning. And also good because don't spend your spare time on the internet. Spend your spare time of thinking, dreaming about what you could do to make it better. Okay? So I'm going to introduce briefly what content-defined chunking is, the motivation, and why we wanted to look at some way to make it better, and the approach that we took. I'm going to introduce what we mean by bimodal chunking algorithms, and I'm going to try to make it really clear why transition regions are something that are important to consider. I'm going to show some example algorithms. They're very easy. We're going to show them as diagrams, you know, no pseudocode or anything like that. And we're going to look at the results, and we're going to spend some time on looking at whether our ideas of what came in on the input stream during these backups really matched what conception we had at the beginning when we started developing some new algorithm. So in content-defined chunking, what you have is an input stream, and you can imagine sliding a local window of bytes, byte-wise, over this input stream, maybe a window of 40 bytes, 60 bytes, 100 bytes, or something like that. And at each window position, you'll evaluate some function and get a stream of function values. The next step you do is you select a subset of these function values as, you know, somehow they've got something special about them. We're going to generate a cut point there. Our chunk boundary, a chunk is going to end at that place. So in this way, we get content-defined chunking, and we get variably-sized chunks. Now, the nice thing about this, if you think about it, is that if you have a small edit operation, such as a replace, insert, or delete, only a small chunk is likely to be affected by a small edit operation that's isolated. For this reason, people often use content-defined chunking to store backup data. We have multiple versions of a file system, for example. The metric people use to measure how well they're doing is the duplicate elimination ratio, which is just the ratio of input bytes over stored bytes, or DER. You want high duplicate elimination ratio. So what goes into just the normal content-defined chunking? Well, you need to define a window size, a function that you evaluate on that window, and you keep these parameters fixed for all what you do for the rest. The more interesting parameters are something that determines the average chunk size that you produce. So this depends on the selection function, the predicate that you use to say, do we chunk here or not? Is this function value special or not? Usually we use just a very simple selector. You know, if the value of the function has 10 least significant bits 0, take it. So for every 1,024 queries, you expect to get one match, and this will generate an average chunk size of 1,000 bytes or so. Now, the bad thing about this is that you're sort of randomly selecting things. The average chunk size has a geometrically decreasing distribution of chunk sizes. So you get a lot of small chunks, which is exactly what you don't want in your storage system. So most people put in a minimum chunk size. We won't even consider chunks below some minimum chunk size. And because we're programmers and we, you know, want things easy for us, we also put in a maximum chunk size and say, if you get chunks that are too large, you just chop them off. Unfortunately, those are now no longer content defined. So, well, you can do something a little bit clever and say, oh, for those particular max chunk, we can choose a backup cut point that is content defined, and at least we have a chance of getting something, finding it again in the duplicate input stream. So, just schematically, what we have in this picture is we have duplicate elimination ratio on the y-axis and average chunk size shown here as a log scale on the x-axis. We want to move in the direction of the green arrow. We want to get to large chunk size and or large duplicate elimination ratio. It turned out for our data that we did get straight lines on these log plots, but there's no particular a priori reason to expect this sort of size independent or fractal behavior or anything like that. So what can you do to improve a chunking algorithm? Well, you need some other data input. This could be a characteristic of the input stream. For example, you can think of looking at local entropy estimation to get a compressibility estimate and do something. Or you can use whatever other easily available information you have. We happen to have a back-end storage system, HydroStore, that did inline deduplication. And as part of doing the normal write processing, they had to have a fast mechanism to say, is this a duplicate chunk or not? So the easy thing for us to do was say, what can we do if we expose this existence query in the API and allow our chunker to have access to one new function call that returns a yes or no, duplicate or non-duplicate result. Most of this was done with one archive data, and talking with other people here, there's a universal problem that most people don't like you looking at their private data. I mean, even if you don't look at it, they don't even want you touching it or reading it. We managed to get, we had a good friend in IT, and he managed to get us access to the tapes, and we went in there and we read off tapes, and out of 14 backups, we managed to get 1.1 terabyte of readable tape archives, which was pretty good. Tape archives is write once, read never, you hope, medium. And what we did then was we took a chunking summary of this, sort of a low-level description of this 1.1 terabytes, and it allowed us to run through this huge data set hundreds of times with different chunking parameters and see what would we get if we changed chunking parameters, if we changed chunking algorithms. So here's the very simple picture of the original case where we have unimodal chunking. Here I've shown large chunk size on average, and you have this geometrical decreasing distribution. You have a min chunk there in the distribution and a max chunk. Now we are adding to the block repository a simple function that allows the chunker to modify its decision making, and based on the duplicate or non-duplicate assignments, existence queries, we're going to possibly chunk small or possibly chunk big. So bimodal, because there's now two different averages going on. So that's where the name came from. Now the intuitive model of file system that everybody knows, that's fairly often quoted, is that you're going to have large stretches of the file system which are the same from backup to backup, from backup 14, backup 20, backup 50. They're all going to be the same. You're going to have regions that change more frequently, sort of regions of frequent change. So the two things we took around here was that, first of all, we expect to see these long stretches of unseen data, and since we want to get large average chunk size, the correct thing we better end up doing is chunking these large, with large average chunk size. The other sort of corollary is that we do expect our original data to have high duplicate elimination ratio to begin with. The intuition we had about these change regions was that if you consider the byte at which you change from a duplicate region to a non-duplicate region, there's possibly an inefficiency that's going on here. Because short blocks, if you have a short block, you can more clearly zero in on where that change is occurring, if you think about it. And existence queries, the sole purpose of the existence queries was a way to determine at least a region where these transition, byte-wise transition between duplicates and non-duplicates were occurring. So let's just make a picture of this. First time through your backup, everything's new, let's say. You chunk everything large. Second time through your backup, you have a duplicate region in red. Oh, and then you find a non-duplicate region. This could be a region of frequent change. It might occur later. We don't know yet. It's just non-duplicate. And then we go back to duplicate. So let's consider a large average chunk size. There's a large average chunk in red shown there. That's a duplicate. But now because of that byte transition from duplicate to non-duplicate, that whole large chunk in that transition region would be emitted as a large chunk. Now, if you consider instead what would happen if you can chunk that small, as shown, the first small chunk is entirely within the duplicate byte region. And on backup 3, backup 4, backup 5, and if you're in marketing on backup 20, you're going to see that chunk again, for sure. It doesn't actually work that well. But that's the idea. That's the hope. Now, that boundary between duplicate and non-duplicate regions really is completely independent of where the large chunk lies. So that boundary could be within the first small chunk, second, third, or fourth small chunk, roughly with equal probability, one expects. So for the first small chunk, 3 out of 4 times, it's entirely within the duplicate region of data. So it's going to be seen at backup 3, 4, 5, 20, whatever. Whereas the last chunk is certainly not within the same duplicate region as the original. So it might have some duplicate re-emission probability, but it's going to be some nominal bulk small chunk re-emission probability. So this is the key idea. Everybody agrees it's simple? Great. So the algorithm is really not much more complicated than the previous slide. We start off by doing existence queries, grabbing the easy things first, the big large chunks that are duplicate. We definitely want to re-emit those. And what remains, there's transition regions and extended non-duplicate regions. Transition regions, we just chunk them small, and you know, suggestively I've shown one small chunk on the left and 2 small chunks on the right that we expect to see again on backups 3, 4, 5, etc. You could also do this instead of from a top-down approach. You could start with a small chunking and amalgamate chunks to form larger chunks. The difference here is that because we have more possibilities for where we position the larger chunks, there's potentially a better description of what's going on in terms of duplication. We have to pay the price of emitting more existence queries in this case. There's also an interesting sort of thing to play with that, you know, maybe you can do better. But the simplest thing to program, and therefore the thing we tried first, was just let's concatenate k small chunks to form a large chunk. That's what we're going to define as a large chunk. You might be able to think of some better definitions. There are some. Now, the first thing you do, you check duplication status to find all the previous large chunks. So this could take up to 1 query per small chunk, or k queries per large chunk. And you re-emit the duplicates. What remains is either a transition region or an extended non-duplicate, and it, you know, the processing is pretty much as before. Well, you might actually want to emit large chunks that are a concatenation of 2 to k large chunks, or even 1 to k large chunks. One large chunk, well, that's basically your, in the querying stage, you're going to be querying for existence of even small chunks to redetect those and emit them. So, but the cost of that is now you're going from order of k queries per large chunk to order of k squared queries per large chunk. So there's, you know, you might need, that might break the bank when it comes to processing speed. So let's just take a look more carefully before we proceed to see if some of our guesses. So we have a crystal ball. We put our whole 1.1 terabytes in there. And then we ask for various subcases, do we actually see this small chunk for like a duplicate transition region, non-duplicate? Do we actually see you again? What's the probability that we're going to see you again in the future? So we asked our little woman here, and she said, well, if you have 8 small chunks between duplicate bigs, you're 85 to 90% likely you're going to see them again in the future. So this is like, you know, a very great subcase. For the subcase where we had a transition from duplicate to transition region to non-duplicate, we do sort of see things tailing off as you go to large chunk size on the far right. Here on the y-axis, it's the probability of seeing that small chunk later on. And on the x-axis is the position of the small chunk from 1 to 8. Here we ran one algorithm. Amalgamating 8 small chunks was our definition of a big chunk. And we ran it for various different small chunk sizes, from 6K small chunk size to 24K average small chunk size. And what we see is that, you know, we identify a nominal small chunk re-emission probability of around 65% for the orange lines, which are 8K input chunk size. Actually, if I were doing this for marketing, I'd show that at 55%, because if you look at globally everything chunk small, it's around 55%. But, you know, this is what it looks like just... And that 65%, it's the same whether we use k equals 8, k equals 4, k equals 16, k equals 32. It all tends out to about the same value when you look at what happens at that very last small chunk. Another thing you can do to look at your input data is for every chunk that has a unique successor, let's just merge them and consider a larger chunk. This doesn't affect the duplicate elimination ratio, But it gives you some sort of theoretical, easy to calculate. Oh, no, sorry, it's not easy to calculate because we have 400 million alphabet in our string view of the problem. But it you can get 10 times larger average chunk size by doing a simple procedure. Of course, it would be impractical in practice to just always guess how many small chunks to concatenate. So we're not going to get that well because we're doing something considerably simpler. But we actually get a substantial ways by doing something very simple toward this sort of optimal limit. I've just shown a teaser here of what you can get if you're willing to do a lot of existence queries. So in the brown line, we're doing 56 queries per large chunk, and the black line, we're doing 64 queries per large chunk. So we're even detecting, asking about small chunks, whether they're in the data stream already or not. More practical queries, however, lie in the light brown region there. Now, it looks like, you know, so what? It's barely moving over. But if you look at it, it's a log scale. So if you look at it, this is, even the light brown line is 50% larger chunk sizes. Now, this is somewhat interesting because the original reason why HydroStore uses these huge chunk sizes is for I/O speed. You know, potentially, even 50% increase in average chunk size is 50% less random I/O going on your underlying storage system. We're going to look at two effects really quickly. Compression basically does what you expect. It has a big effect at small chunk sizes. So going from 8K to 12K is a big difference. Going from 60K to 80K is not such a big difference because at larger block sizes, your compressibility is more determined by the underlying entropy of your input stream. So no surprises there. For metadata, also there's no surprises. It's just a simple formula to transform from your original duplicate elimination ratio to your DER primed. You just divide your original one by 1 plus F, where F is the metadata over the chunk size. Now, I've shown 100, 400, or 800 bytes here as typical examples of how your duplicate elimination ratio goes down. So why you want large chunk sizes. But the other thing, just a sort of snide comment here that I'm going to get in trouble for probably, is that this is also time. When you first have a product, you're lean and mean, and you have very little metadata. And after 1 year, after 4 years, after 8 years, people have all these necessary features for which they absolutely need some new metadata added. And products have somehow tend to evolve, unfortunately, to not be so lean and mean as new features get added in. Here we have breaking apart a sequence of things where I'm just showing you what sort of typical parameters we used for the main chunker. 1 to 2 to 3 was what we often used for the baseline chunker. It worked reasonably well. And now we have some curves for breaking apart. This is now one existence query per big chunk, so not a lot of work. And we break apart the large chunking into one small chunk. Oh, well, that's a no-op. So you see it is on the same curve. Into 2 small chunks on average, 4 small, 8, 16. 32, I don't think I showed. It actually got worse in some cases. But the interesting thing was that around k equals 4 or 8 smalls per chunk, it seemed to work, over a large region of baseline chunker sizes. There are some other small points that don't really show much difference, but you can play with min and average and max settings and have small improvements. But it's on the scale of improvements we're looking at, it's not really worth going for that. Amalgamation algorithms. Here's the order of k queries are the black pentagons and the big black squares. So these are, maybe feasible in terms of amount of existence queries going on. And just for fun, I've shown 4 points for compressed and uncompressed with 64 queries per small chunk. Now, the interesting thing is that the axes on this and the previous graph are about the same. And that for large chunk sizes, even one existence query per large chunk is doing almost as well as 8 existence queries per large chunk. So what we've actually convinced people to do is to put this in as an option in a future version of the product, just so we can get access to real data sets to see how it does on real data. We took a look at some of our historical intuitions again, and we found out that actually we didn't have this model of long, unseen, repeated stretches of data whatsoever in our backup data. There's number of duplicates, number of following non-duplicates. You'd expect to see a large proportion of data with long strings of duplicates, but in fact we had a very high proportion of data with small stretches of duplicates followed by small stretches of non-duplicates. But nevertheless, what we did worked reasonably well. The second sort of intuition, well, that was pretty much corroborated by these Oracle experiments where we actually did have the good emission probabilities. For some other data sets, they don't really conform to our model for backup data at all, and performance was really sketchy. You can see figures for the various sort of source code archives, and it didn't really work very well. When you think about my explanation justifying the small chunk transition probabilities, you'll remember I said something, well, this first small chunk, we're going to see it again at backup 3, 4, and 5. Well, for Emacs, for example, the uncompressed duplicate and elimination ratio for these small 8K chunks was only 1.73. So do you really expect to see it again at backup 3, 4, and 5? Well, no, not really. So the takeaway here was that even though it really didn't conform to what we expected at all for the model of backup data, at least we didn't make it worse, which is definitely possible. These are only heuristics. There's no guarantee of actually making things better. So in conclusion, for archival data that already has some sort of minimally good duplicate elimination ratio, chunking transition regions small is a really simple idea to get a mechanism to get smaller, larger chunk sizes and maintain reasonable duplicate elimination ratio. What we did to detect these transition regions was just adding an existence query to our block store API, exposing some internals that were already there and working reasonably fast. Small chunks in transition regions can show pretty high recurrence probabilities later on. Now, I still have a little bit of time. Way, yay. So the thing to be amazed with is that we have added no metadata to anything that's stored to do this. We are doing not even any post-processing to go back and fix up possibly bad decisions that we've made and re-chunk things. If we can do really interesting, things interesting enough to prod Japan into saying, yeah, do this, see how it works on real customer data, how much better could we do if we were actually allowed to add 1 or 2 or 10 bytes of metadata? What other approaches are there out there just waiting for brilliant minds to figure them out and implement them and see what happens? Thank you. Oh, I'm reminded by my supervisor, we are hiring.
Kaushik Viraghavan, University of Michigan. I had a quick question about the actual overhead in running, one existence query versus 8 versus 64, and how that differed from if you were running it over large chunks versus small chunks.
I'm not exactly sure. I think we were getting 20,000 existence queries per second, but the thing that people worry about more, at least what I took away, was how it's going to impact ongoing read and write speed. Because now you're adding something that is interfering with the path that you want to be very fast.
Right. So the reason I asked is because I'm thinking if you can do 64 later on and that makes you find graphic for some reason, maybe online you just do 8 queries and then you take a certain chunking strategy, but afterwards you can go back on that data, find the 64 extends query, and then we maybe it's just a one pass thing, right? But then that comes out to what the actual cost of running 8 versus 16 versus 64.
I think the cost of an existence query doesn't matter how big the chunk is. The existence query, it's the number of existence queries per second that you're doing that's important. But, you know, that's one area that people should think of. You know, is it easy in your back-end storage system to go back in the future and redo decisions? We started out from the beginning with saying, we're not going to redo any decision that we made. We're going to decide and we're going to stick with it. Very simple. But yeah, going back over your data, you can think about even doing very complicated sort of compression style views of it. We've got essentially a string of blocks. Our alphabet is very large. It's the set of permissible blocks. But you know, people are writing papers about context-free grammars over countably infinite alphabets. So there's, you know, a lot of fundamental computer science research that maybe will be doable. I don't know exactly what overhead you need in terms of metadata to do context-free grammar style compression approaches. But there's a lot to think about, at least.
Hi, this is Guan Ling from University of Minnesota. This is very interesting work. And the question I have is, how do you identify the duplicate and non-duplicated region from the backup stream? I mean, from the very beginning of stage, like, for example, from the backup one and backup two, something like that?
It's purely on the basis of, do you already exist? Are you already stored there or not? That's the only information we're using to determine the duplicate regions.
Okay, I see. So you interpret that from the large size chunking which you've done on the first and the second backup, right, to find the existence information.
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a Randall Burns, Johns Hopkins. There's some history about doing multi-resolution similarity detection in differencing, and now you've done the same thing in this deduplication context. And I'm surprised and interested that you found for certain file workloads it doesn't work, that you're leveraging backup semantics, and yet that would seem to disagree with the kind of multi-resolution similarity detection that's been so successful in Taper and network synchronization protocols. Can you give me some intuition as to why you think it doesn't work for more general purpose file workloads, source code trees, things like that?
More general purpose? Well, we only have like the source code archive data set. But why it doesn't work is
because... Or think broader. So you've said for backup, and you've shown that, which is nice, but does this work for everything? Could I put this in a live file system if I could run my duplication system faster?
I'm not sure. It's an interesting question, because when we decide to chunk a transition region small, we're taking a hit. We're paying a price for that chunking it small decision. It's hard for me to explain. But there's no guarantee that that loss that we take that very first time we chunk a transition small is ever going to be recouped again. Maybe there's a difference in that we're providing absolutely no guarantees. You could easily cook up or imagine a data set that would make this work very badly. Whereas maybe in these multi-resolution approaches, you're guaranteed of, you know, making some positive progress. And here we have no guarantee of positive progress, so we really have to assume something, you know, this DER of 3 to 4 at least, in order for our assumptions to be validated later on, or hopes to be validated later on.
Hi, Hugo Patterson at EMC. You could imagine that the transition region of backup 3 becomes the large dedupe chunk of backup 4. Did you look for that, or did you find that, or is that not correct?
Let's take this offline. I'm not sure I follow your question.
Oh, I just mean that you have long range of dedupe. Let's say a file is inserted into the source. So now the backup includes that file. And so there's a little bit of region of change for the first backup that includes it. But all the subsequent backups include that file. And so now, yes, you have one backup with this little bit of transition, but the reality is for the next backup and forevermore, you include that file, and so you end up doing all this work, but you know, the larger chunk would have worked fine if you could have known about the next backup?
I think my way to approach that is to view what's happening really in the transition regions. If it really is a region of frequent change, or you know, if it is, like you're suggesting, a region that's actually going to be fully duplicated later on, and I don't think it matters. What is important is that's, if you think about it carefully, that's transition region will still be chunked with small chunks later on. So it will be deduplicated, but just with small chunks at the beginning, which is good if you think about it.
I think I understood what you're getting at. So,
okay. So those transition regions will be rechunked small if you see them again, and the non-duplicate region became a duplicate in backup 4, like you're suggesting. So it ends up doing the right thing. A caveat here is that we had like a big impulse to think of very complicated mechanisms to do very fancy things. And almost without fail, when I tried a very fancy algorithm, it didn't work. It worked badly or it just didn't work at all. And it took a lot of figuring out, and there was always something that went wrong. So, you know, Occam's razor, keep it simple, just make it work, is like pretty good.